Good morning. Welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work that's being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's a part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me once again this week, I think this is our third conversation, Dr. Annie Laurie Benzi, MD, Assistant Professor of Surgery at Hackensack Meridian Health School of Medicine, and General and Minimally Invasive Complex GI Surgeon at Hackensack Meridian Health Specialty Group. Good morning once again.
Good morning. I know they say the third time's the charm, so thank you so much for having me back, and I can't wait to have this discussion with you, Joel.
Yeah, let's jump in. I mean, I think the first two were quite charmed, but we'll go for the third charm as well. We wanted to start with, and you know, we want to hone in on this specific thing, and that is reflux. But I've heard of acid reflux, but there's something called that we're going to be talking about. I guess the question is, what is silent reflux? Is there a difference there? I've never heard of that until we planned this conversation.
Sure. So if you may have guessed, it's actually not so silent, but traditional acid reflux or heartburn is what people describe, that burning sensation that comes up in the middle of their chest, and that is actually due to an abundance of gastric acid that is passing into the esophagus, which is the food tube, the one that helps us swallow. Mm-hmm. So there is a subset of population of patients that don't experience that heartburn, but what they do experience is that acid actually coming up the entire way up to their voice box, which is known as the larynx, as well as the back of their throat, which is known as the pharynx. So when you put that all together, the medical term for that is laryngeal-pharyngeal reflux, also known as LPR, which I'm probably going to say for the rest of this
talk. Yeah, good idea. You got it right the first time. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that is what we call silent reflux because it happens in a set of population of our patients that don't have true heartburn, but they do have very serious symptoms in the back of their throat.
I see. So it has nothing to do with any sound. It's just that you're not getting the burning, but you're getting all the other negative effects.
Exactly. And if anything, the sound that actually comes out is a cough. So the number one presentation of these patients is actually having a chronic cough. And I've seen actually a patient in the office this week that's had a cough for over a year, has had multiple visits with pulmonologists, different medications, different kinds of testing, and they really can't get to the root source of her cough. And then she herself actually read an article that was written about one of my other patients having a chronic cough for almost 2 years and found me, and now we're investigating her for having silent reflux.
And so it's a constant coughing.
So pretty much throughout the day, tends to get worse after meals. Mm-hmm. So especially spicy, acidic foods, anything good, like the amazing food that we have here in New Jersey that's a little heavier, mm-hmm. That tends to promote traditional heartburn or reflux as well. But these patients kind of have this nagging cough that won't go away, and also a hoarseness of their voice. And can even lose their voice by the end of the day because the acid just is washing over their vocal cords so much that it just causes such chronic irritation.
Is it something that you develop sometimes with age? Because I know, you know, I talk with my mom and she's in her late 80s. And whenever we're talking, she'll say something. She's got to do that a lot. Could that be the same thing or totally different? It's just an aging thing where, you know.
Yeah, lots of fun things happen when we get a little bit older, don't they? But yeah, it can be one of those things as well because these patients also, and in general, as people age, sometimes we lose a little bit of the function of the natural valves that exist within our esophagus that actually prevent that reflux from coming up and over. So it's not uncommon that patients notice, you know, as they get to their like 30s, 40s, 50s, they've never had heartburn, but all of a sudden they have to do this chronic throat clearing. And that's because the nerves and the muscles that work in our esophagus, you know, tend to be a little less strong, just like every muscle in our body, like our biceps do. And then when you get to your 70s, 80s, all those muscles tend to actually atrophy, which means they really lose their muscle mm-hmm. tension. So that can happen. The other part of silent reflux is actually having that material from your stomach or esophagus actually come all the way up into your nasal passages. So that kind of leads to a chronic sinusitis, which is inflammation of those nasal passages, which can lead to post-nasal drip as well. So that definitely can cause that throat clearing sensation, because now you're getting mucus as well coming down from the top, as well as the acid coming from the bottom. So it's kind of a two-directional problem that it creates.
What do you mean by parts of the stomach coming up? Is that something you ate or an actual piece of your stomach?
It's not a piece of your stomach. It's actually the acid that gets produced by the cells that are in the lining of your stomach.
I gotcha. And then it just comes up, and that's what causes all the issues. So how do you, when a patient comes in, is it obvious usually with the symptoms that you mentioned, or is it sometimes harder to diagnose silent reflux?
Sure. So it's definitely harder than traditional heartburn to diagnose this, because there can actually be a lot of reasons why people have a chronic cough, whether that's a lung issue, allergies, or also medications actually create a chronic cough as well. So a lot of my patients that come with silent reflux have actually been seen by ear, nose, and throat doctors that have gone down with a special camera through their nose and seen that their vocal cords are very, very inflamed. And may have that excessive mucus, like I spoke about as well. So that's usually the first tip-off, you know, that there's something going on. The second part is to do kind of like a clinical exam and also a history. So we like to say that patients will tell us what's wrong with them, and that's very true. But you have to know what questions to ask. So after going through, you know, kind of a series of questions to kind of rule out other issues, patients will usually tell you exactly what's happening. And then, of course, we go to the true diagnostics, which are endoscopy, which is when we put the camera down your esophagus, check your stomach, make sure there's no other reason for you to have these symptoms. And sometimes I actually combine that endoscopy with something called a pH probe test. So what this pH probe test does is actually a temporary device that sits on the wall of the esophagus for about 48 hours. It's connected to a little old-school pager device that some of us may remember from the early 90s that works through Wi-Fi technology. And that little device on the wall of the esophagus actually picks up the degree of acidity coming up from the esophagus to the stomach, which is known as the pH, hence pH probe, the number of times that happens per hour, and the duration of times that happens as well. So even if I have a patient that doesn't have typical heartburn symptoms, doesn't have an underlying hiatal hernia that can lead to gastroesophageal reflux, I can actually tell based on the numbers from the pH probe test if there's truly acid coming up the esophagus, in addition to having those upper kind of LPR symptoms.
Now, you said that it's something similar to an old-style pager in the esophagus. That's not the size of an old pager actually installed into the esophagus, is it?
No. So it's actually it's a little device. It's about the size of a Tylenol or Advil tablet that actually gets clipped on temporarily. And then the pager device is actually something that you wear on your hip.
Outside.
With a Wi-Fi connection. Sorry. Thank you. Don't want to scare people, right? the Wi-Fi connection that is that communicates with the little device that's clipped on temporarily to the wall of the esophagus. So those two communicate together, and that's where the report comes out.
Okay. Now, I'm probably the only one who thought that. And everyone's like, Joel, there's not going to be a, 3-inch by 2-inch piece of plastic inside the esophagus, let's be honest. So once you diagnose, and once you get all the information from that device, what's next?
So the next steps for that is really discussing with the patient how aggressive they would like to be in their treatment plan. So obviously there's medical therapy as well as lifestyle changes that can help these patients first, and that's really what I truly do advocate. A lot of what I do is, as a surgeon, obviously is surgery, but more often when I see patients in the office, I actually do a lot of education about nutrition as well as lifestyle changes that they can do to help with these symptoms. So the first thing that I always tell people is that three large meals a day, kind of old school way of eating, is probably not going to be the best thing for them. No. Usually smaller meals more frequently throughout the day. Don't eat after 6 or 7 o'clock at night when you're about to go to sleep. You don't want to lay down after meals. And of course you want to avoid those things that I mentioned, like spicy, acidic foods, like citrus, caffeine, chocolate, alcohol, smoking as well. You know, it's the best lifestyle decision you could ever make. So really quitting smoking or at least cutting down is something that I really advocate for my patients.
Okay, so all these things, this is what would resolve the issue, or is this the first thing you try?
So this is the first thing that we try. And then after this, we do add different kinds of medications. Those can be over-the-counter medications that basically block the production of a certain histamine in the wall of the stomach. Then there are prescription medications that actually block the production of the acid in the wall of the stomach. And the idea behind those is that the reflux or the movement of things from the stomach to the esophagus may still happen, but it won't be as caustic or acidic as it was previously, so it decreases the amount of inflammation in those areas.
Okay, so we try our eating habits. We eat several smaller meals a day, stay away from spicy foods and everything you mentioned. That doesn't work. And then we get to some medication, and maybe that doesn't work either. Is there another step? Is there a surgery? What else can be done?
Worse. So as I mentioned, I am a surgeon, so I don't like to always operate on everyone. I like to try to do things non-operatively first.
Of course, yeah, sure.
But when it gets to surgery, obviously there are some patients that, for whatever reason, are very resistant. And, of course, everything that we do medication-wise, there are side effects to as well. In particular, with these medications that we use for reflux, you know, there have been shown to be correlation studies now that have to deal with dementia, bone loss, kidney function. So they're really not intended to be for long-term use. That being said, like, I do have patients that are in my office 20, 30 years on these medications, and those are definitely the patients I would counsel to kind of progress towards some more aggressive treatment options.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of silent reflux, patients that don't have large hiatal hernias, which is more of a plumbing or a structural issue, there are two options. One is something that we can do endoscopically. And what that is known is a transoral incisionless fundoplication, or a TIF. So what this procedure is actually done by Advanced Gastroenterology, which we have right here at JFK University Medical Center. Dr. Ann DeLieb, I work with him very closely.
I've spoken with him, yeah, sure.
Perfect. And he is actually able, through a regular endoscopy, to go down and recreate that valve that exists between the esophagus and the stomach, make it longer and stronger, and that helps create a barrier between having that contents of the stomach, that acid secretion, actually come up from the stomach to the esophagus.
That's a little flap that you would normally have, but if it wears away, that's when you might have this issue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then the other option for patients that do have concomitant hiatal hernias at the same time, which means the top part of their stomach tends to go back and forth between the chest and the abdomen. That's usually when I get involved. And what I'm able to offer these patients is a robotic transabdominal surgery. So the incisions are very, very small on the belly wall. And I actually go in and fix the hiatal hernia, so return everything to the spot that it was intended to be. And then I can actually create that natural, or recreate or make it stronger, that valve internally. And what I actually do is wrap the top part of the stomach around the back of the esophagus. Kind of looks like a little hot dog in a bun, or a pig in a blanket, as I like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And that also makes the valve longer and stronger to prevent that acid from coming up, but also addressing the plumbing problem, which is the hiatal hernia, at the same time.
I see. Talking with Dr. Annie Laurie Benzi, MD, Assistant Professor of Surgery at Hackensack Meridian Health School of Medicine and General and Minimally Invasive Complex GI Surgeon at Hackensack Meridian Health Specialty Group. So what's the worst case scenario when it comes to when it comes to silent reflux? What are the biggest risks if untreated or otherwise?
So when I have patients that have silent reflux, their biggest issues are that chronic cough. Obviously, socially, it's challenging, but also it tends to have people take a large variety of medications that don't really work because they don't address the underlying problem. And as I mentioned, every medication or intervention we do is not without side effects. So that is the biggest challenge in treating these patients. The other thing that can happen, and this also happens in patients that do have traditional GERD or heartburn, is that washing over of the acid secretions from the stomach over the esophagus and the upper airway, it does create little changes in the cells in those areas over time that actually make those cells turn over quickly. So when things turn over quickly, or they kind of regenerate and replace themselves and cut stuff off, the DNA in those cells can actually change quickly in a way that is unchecked. And unfortunately, that can lead to conditions such as Barrett's esophagus in the lower esophagus, which is something I think is becoming more prevalent.
What is that called again? I'm sorry.
It's called Barrett's esophagus.
Barrett's esophagus. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's a condition where the cells in the esophagus actually change their shape to a different form of cell. And unfortunately, we know now that eventually, over 10, 20 years, those changes in those cells can actually lead to esophageal cancer. So obviously, that's something that we would like to prevent. And the other challenge with that is even medications, they prevent the burning sensation, but they don't prevent the physiological movement of things back and forth. So although patients may not be experiencing that heartburn anymore, because those cells are still being washed over by the gastric fluid, these changes can still occur. And unfortunately, without proper surveillance and follow-up, even if patients are taking medication, sometimes Barrett's esophagus can occur as well, and unfortunately can lead to esophageal cancer.
Right. So you need to continue your checkups, even though, let's say you're taking medication and it takes care of the problem, you're saying that it could still lead to, and you won't even know it, to this Barrett's esophagus, which leads to esophageal cancer.
Exactly. So if someone that's on long-term medication should always be following up with a gastroenterologist or reflux specialist, because they will need continuous surveillance endoscopies, usually about every 3 to 5 years on those medications, just to make sure that the lining of the esophagus hasn't had this change or transition. And even once Barrett's esophagus is diagnosed, those patients need even more stringent follow-ups to make sure that those changes that progress towards esophageal cancer are not happening.
Is this at any degree of the silent reflux? Like, we talked about the different treatments, and we started antacids would be the first attempt, right? So if antacids, you know, over-the-counter antacids take care of the issue, is there still just as much of a risk there, or any risk at all?
Sure. So the patients that take antacids are usually patients that don't have daily symptoms. Once it gets to a point where there's daily symptoms is usually when people start to upgrade their medication regimen or even consider seeing a physician for that workup. So I like to tell my patients, even after like having a corrective surgery, if you go out and eat pepperoni pizza, you're going to have reflux and heartburn just like the rest of us, but it won't be as serious as those daily chronic symptoms that you have. So it really depends on the degree of symptoms that each patient has and also the time period. So progression to Barrett's esophagus is usually, like I mentioned, about 10, 15 years of having chronic daily reflux symptoms.
Okay.
Progression to esophageal cancer is usually about 15 to 20 years until we see those changes. So it's a slow time period, but you know, the years creep up on you, and you never want to get to that point where you waited too long either.
Right, but you could see, you as a doctor, you know, you can see it coming.
Yep, it can be predictable. Yep, and that's why it's really important to follow up with someone that you trust and someone that will do the proper surveillance that you need.
So if someone starts out with just, you know, it starts out with the minimal issue and they start taking the antacids, let's say, is it inevitable that eventually it's going to get, if it's not treated, it will get to the Barrett's esophagus? Or is it different for everyone, you know?
Sure. So it doesn't happen in every single patient. It tends to happen in patients that also have other conditions, like cigarette smoking, exposure to nitrates. Certain ethnic groups are actually more predisposed to Barrett's esophagus as well. So it's not every patient, you know, that eats some marinara sauce and then has a little heartburn and then needs to take some Tums, and they don't necessarily need to come see me or a gastroenterologist. But it's really that patient population that has a lot of risk factors and has chronic reflux that has not been followed by a physician. Those are the patients that I truly worry about more than others.
What you said, nitrates. I know, I don't know much about, I just know they're in hot dogs. Is that correct? So,
yes.
But you would think that they would be in spicy foods primarily, based on our conversation. So along with cigarettes and smoking, you need to stay away from that. What type of foods are good to stay away from that you wouldn't be obvious, like pepperoni, as you mentioned?
Exactly. So nitrates are really present in any kind of smoked meats or processed meats. So you can't actually buy hot dogs now without nitrates in them. They're a little more expensive than your typical hot dog. But a lot of the research, especially in Asian countries, has shown a very high correlation between nitrates and smoked meat and actually fish, cigarette smoking, and having esophageal cancer.
Whoa. Fish?
Yep, smoked fish as well.
Smoked fish, okay. Good.
Fish,
so I'm okay with fish, right?
Exactly. So fish sticks, all good. But when you have a diet that's, you know, every day kind of eating like smoked fish, I definitely would get a little bit more nervous, especially if you do have those other underlying conditions. And in general, it's really like the deli meats, like salami, pepperoni, things that we have here in the United States that tend to be a little bit riskier. You know, and just in general, it's better to eat foods that are not processed, because all processed foods that are on the inside borders of the grocery store, as we like to say, they do obviously have chemicals that I think have been shown or will be shown in the future to create more health issues as well.
And we're talking about the meats that you get at the deli counter that they're slicing for you, along with bologna that you get in a package and things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Talking with Dr. Annie Laurie Benzi, Assistant Professor of Surgery, Hackensack Meridian Health School of Medicine, and General Minimally Invasive Complex GI Surgeon at Hackensack Meridian Health Specialty Group. I do want to point out before we call it a day, and we pretty much covered much of your article. You have an article at HackensackMeridianHealth.org, very informative about everything that we've discussed this morning.
Yes, so I actually have several articles now, a couple of podcasts, as well as interviews about reflux. So part of my mission and part of my job here at JFK and part of Hackensack Meridian Health was actually founding the JFK University Medical Center Reflux and Motility Center. So what that is a one-stop shop, so to speak, for patients that are having any kind of reflux or swallowing disorder. So we're actually able to do complete assessment, workup, diagnostic testing, and treatment, endoscopically and surgery for patients all under one house, which is not something that is typical. And it's actually one of the only centers here in New Jersey and definitely in the central region of New Jersey that has the capability of offering these kinds of advanced procedures as well as comprehensive workup.
Yeah, could you give us the name of the program once again? Because I know we talked about it, I'm going to say about a year and a half ago, we focused on that in one of our conversations. It was new at the time. So give us you know, how's it going? And the name again.
Sure. So it's the JFK University Medical Center Reflux and Motility Program, and it's on site here at JFK, so 65 James Street, Edison, New Jersey. My office is right across the street, so it's very conveniently located. And we're in our second year now of a full rollout of our program. And over the course of the last year, like I mentioned, Dr. Annalieve has joined JFK. And with his assistance, we're actually able to offer more advanced endoscopic procedures that previously we had to send out to other facilities as well. So I'm very excited that he and his group have joined. And in general, we've had many patients actually go through the program now. I've probably done about 40 to 50 operations over the last 2 years. And then Dr. Annalieve, since he's joined, has started doing procedures regularly every week as well. So we work together and kind of coordinate the best care for our patients in terms of decision-making and their particular treatment algorithms as well.
Dr. Benzi, thank you once again.
Of course, it's been a pleasure, and look forward to the next time.
Yes, me as well. For more information, go to jfkmc.org, or for a podcast of this broadcast, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com or magic983.com. JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz. We talk again next week.